Those of you who have been here before notice that on the walls of our church today we have these symbols of various of the world's religions. Those of you here for the first time don't realize that they've never been there before. We just put them up on Saturday. This is the conclusion of actually many years of aspiration to put something like this into this temple in order to fulfill the purpose for which this temple is dedicated, which is a subtle one. And I'm going to try to speak about it a little bit, and then afterwards we'll light a candle at each of those shrines as a way of welcoming them into this space and honoring them. Yogananda, when he spoke of the mission that he brought to the West in 1920 when he came from India, he's the founding inspiration here, he spoke of what he brought, and when he founded churches in the West, he called them churches of all religions. And in fact, in his first church, he had two pulpits. He had one on one side where he would speak from, and then one on the other side where visiting ministers would speak. In fact, there were never any visitor ministers who came and spoke, so he dedicated that whole system and never actually utilized it. He put around his churches symbols such as you see here, various ones. At Lake Shrine, he put symbols of various religions, statues of various great saints, other than the masters of his particular line. Simultaneously, the altar that you see behind me with the particular pictures, it's slightly amended today because we have extra Jesus and extra Master and extra Babaji, but the pictures of these five gurus placed in a cross or in a line was also something that Yogananda himself put forward. So on one hand, you have a temple in which there's a very specific lineage honored and always honored in the same way. And then in the other way, you have statues. He put statues of various figures, St. Francis, Krishna, and others, and symbols, as I'm saying here. And then he called it all religions. But in fact, when he would work from scripture, he would only read from the Bhagavad Gita and primarily from the New Testament, a little bit from the Old Testament, mostly from the New Testament. And in fact, when one of his students said to him, "Why do you call it all religions when really you're just dealing with Hinduism and Christianity?" And instead of giving a sort of reasoned answer about it, his answer was very interesting. He said simply, "It was the will of Babaji that we do it this way." Now, Babaji is the figure at the top of the cross there. Babaji, for those of you who've read Autobiography of a Yogi, you know, is an ever-living Himalayan yogi. He's one of those who has the power to keep his body for as long as he wishes. This is written in Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda's book. I can't personally attest to it, but when everything else that you can test proves true, you're inclined to believe that which you can't test also. You come to that on your own. But Babaji's power, and then Yogananda tells the story in Autobiography, and we repeat it every week in the Festival of Light. Jesus appeared to the great master Babaji and said, "The high altar of my church, of inner communion with the Lord, the candles there are growing dim. My followers still remember to do good works, but they've forgotten the essence of my message, which is to meditate on God and to experience God within." And Babaji and Jesus together agreed that it was time to bring a renewal to Western spirituality. And all of this is the background that brings us right here to this point. Why would a great master, Yogananda, born in India, come to America at a young age and spend his whole life here? You know, we tend to think of people who are not like us as being somehow not as good as us, but as Master points out, people who are not us think of us as not as good as them. Ignorance is 50-50, as he put it, wherever you divide it. Coming to the West for a devout Hindu was considered to go to the most heathen possible country, you know, to abandon sort of all hope of spirituality and go into this land of sensuality and materialism where the traditions are not honored at all. And Yogananda was considered quite a brave and stalwart figure to come to this country. We just think he was coming to the land of indoor plumbing and lots of money, you know, but there are many values in life. Also in Autobiography of a Yogi, Master makes a very interesting statement. He says, Babaji has been concerned, Babaji and Jesus Christ together have been concerned about the development of the West with wars and excessive materialism and sectarianism and all the things that are not of an uplifting nature. And at the same time, and we have this quote on the wall, it's a little small for you to see, Babaji says, I perceive potential saints in America waiting to be awakened. So, in other words, a lot more is going on here than is just obvious. And we find ourselves in a very interesting period in the development of our planet, in the development of our country. You know, America has always been capable of taking care of itself and of being very prosperous. We find ourselves now quite embroiled with the whole world, and even our ability to direct our own destiny is getting all tangled up in political and economic ways. I'm sure many of you are far more knowledgeable about that than I. I don't find it necessary to read the newspapers or watch the news because enough people tell me about it. And all it does is, as Swamiji says, it's just gossip. What can you do about it? But when we think of it not so much in terms of human destiny, but in great waves of cosmic energy, of which we are just little players, we are just little bubbles on this great sea of changing realities in a cosmic sense. And this line of masters came to America, came to the planet at the call of Babaji, at the call of Jesus, in order to bring all of us to a deeper level of understanding of what true spirituality is. Yogananda made the rather grand statement, self-realization has come to unite all religions. Well, the way we normally think in external terms, we think, well, Catholic Church had their turn and now it's our turn, isn't it? You know, we'll just make some great super edifice and we'll declare ourselves to be the one true teaching and, well, that'll be that, won't it? You know, and pretty soon we'll exchange all of these humble settings for more and more lavish ones and things will get more and more gilded and expensive and so on. I went to the Vatican just to tour once and I was just astonished just by the wealth, just the magnitude of worldly collections that go on there. Amazing, because once we start thinking in terms of power, it leads to money, it leads to that kind of force. Well, Yogananda's mission to the West had nothing to do with that. It's for Dwapar Yuga, it's for a new age, it's for an age of energy and an age of consciousness. And when he said self-realization has come to unite all religions, he did not mean in any way that now the Buddha will be subservient to Yogananda and Jesus will be subservient to Yogananda, nothing like that. He was talking about the principle of self-realization. When he decided to come to America, he named what he was bringing after a principle. He did not call it Yoganandaism or anything like that. He called it self-realization, which was a phrase that existed. He did not invent it. Self-realization is what it says. It is to realize within ourselves who and what we really are. Now, in Kali Yuga, which was the age on this planet which is just ending, it was an age of matter and an age of fixed form and materiality. And if you were a Jew, you couldn't be a Christian. And if you were a Christian, you couldn't be a Buddhist. And if you were a Buddhist, you couldn't be a Hindu. You know, all of these things define themselves in very exact ways. And the definition of all of them was based on external realities. This is my birth. These are my people. This is my actions. These are my dogmas. These are my rituals. And we look at those things right now. Our ashram in Los Angeles, that where Ananda's work is starting, is right in the middle of a very conservative Jewish area, or an area of very conservative Jews, Orthodox and conservative Jews. And so when you walk around the street, you see the men in the hats and with the fringes hanging from their coats, and you see you rarely see men and women walking together, and by their external form, you can tell who they are and what they're doing unmistakably. if you meet an Orthodox Jewish man and you make the mistake of reaching out to shake his hand, he won't shake your hand. Because men and women are strictly separated, lots of things like that. So you can recognize it. You know, and the Christians have their holidays, everybody has their own way of doing it. Swami Kriyananda writes about this in his book called The Hindu Way of Awakening, which is a very good book, and he makes a very important distinction. He says every religious path has two features. One is the way of belief and the way of practice. And we do these prayers, we do this thing, we do this ritual, we do this kind of meditation. The other is the way of awakening. And the way of awakening is that which we do which opens our hearts in understanding to the world and expands our consciousness to perceive a reality greater than the ego and the senses give to us. On the ways of belief, religions vary enormously. And all efforts to bring religious unity when you're dealing with the ways of belief, with all due respect, will fail. I mean, Jews come into this temple and they see Jesus on the altar, and I'm of Jewish background, and there's a handful of us. When I was at Ananda Village, Shivani and Anandi and Asha were the ones. Now we have Shanti and Karen and David Gamow and David and me. So every time some Jewish person comes in here and loves the temple and is totally freaked out by Jesus on the altar, they come and talk to us. And we sort of work them through it. And I was reading through the Festival of Light one day here, and there was an Israeli girl in the audience, and Israelis by necessity, because the whole world is trying to, I mean, all their neighbors are trying to wipe them off the face of the earth, Israelis can be very stalwart in defense of their way of belief. And there's a line in the Festival of Light, your chosen people have always been those of every race and nation who with deep love chose thee. Well, of course, the Jews are the chosen people. So this was very upsetting to her. So she came to me and was, you know, quite annoyed that I had said that. And I thought for a moment and I said, oh, well, what you don't get there is how many ways he refocused Christianity and Hinduism too. You just don't know, you know. He didn't honor any of the ways of belief. What he honored, the Festival of Light honors, what Master honors, is the way of awakening. Because no matter how you climb to the top of the mountain, when you get to the top of the mountain, you're in the same place. And all true religions are an expression of the same facts. And that fact is, I and my Father are one. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And in Hinduism, we speak of it in the tradition of yoga and self-realization. The concept is moksha. The concept is complete freedom, complete transcendence of everything that keeps me separate. Now, the practice of Islam just doesn't look anything, you know, like the practice of Hinduism. But if it's practiced according to the way of awakening, what it does is it breaks down the limited identification with the small self and awakens us to our oneness with the infinite self. How we get there doesn't matter. The important point is that we get there. Now, people's consciousness is expanding. So we're now trying to sort of be friends with each other. The rabbis meet the priests, you know, the priests meet the pujaris meet the, I can't remember the name of the priest for the Islam religion. Iman, yes, exactly, right there. And then everybody meets everybody. And we all shake hands and we're very nice to each other. And then we all go home knowing, you know, that our way is really right, but those people are not really terrible, are they? Because externally, we can only get so close. This is the experience of life that we all have. You know, you fall in love with someone, you have the added capability of sexual union, you work so hard to kind of smash your bodies together to just see if you can break down the separation. But you can't on that level. Because self-evidently we're different. We just don't merge. Men are different from women. Women are different from men. Old people are different from young people. I was talking to this 25-year-old man yesterday, the day before. We were talking about relationships. I made some reference to having been younger and more beautiful than I am now. And it was so funny. I saw the slight shadow cross his face. It was so dear. I remember also an older woman I knew fell in love with a younger man. And he was, I don't know, he was about 20 years younger. And I was trying to help the situation. And he said to me, "She's 50. I thought, "Well, when you're 50, it'll feel different to you. I don't know how to tell you. You know, you're still like a human being." I was I was absolutely charmed by this article I read by this 90-year-old artist, this woman. I don't even remember her name. She'd been a very bohemian woman, and she was very attractive and had lived a very bohemian life. But now she was 90. And she said, "When a young, handsome man comes into the room, my response is exactly the same. His response, however, is different." You know, we try. We try to create a kind of unified consciousness, but we're all in different realities. But there is an underneath where we're all the same. And each of these different religious traditions, we will never unite them on the way of belief and the way of practice. But where we will unite is the understanding that by these methods, all of us will transcend. And when we transcend, we just laugh at the differences. Yesterday afternoon, we had a memorial service here for the father of Pavani, who's Father Bill Yabrov, Dr. William Yabrov. Has lived and been part of our community for 25 years. And he was a distinguished professor at Santa Clara, had a very notable career as a psychologist and in many different fields. And we had the memorial service here yesterday, and relatives spoke, and a colleague spoke, and so on. And it was so touching to me how absolutely precious every single life is. You know, I only knew Bill, I never knew Bill in his professional life, and I only knew him more or less toward the end of his life. You know, so for me to think of him as a distinguished professor holding forth in a big lecture hall was a little bit like my telling that young man the other day that I used to be younger and more beautiful than I am. You know, I know it's true, but I never experienced it. But he experienced it. He lived through every little part of it. And just like, you know, a rock into a pond, enormous ripples, in his case, enormous ripples of goodness, just went out in all directions. And so many people were there saying, you know, "He made so much difference in my life." You know, this is where we unify. We don't unify in, "Oh, he was a psychologist, and, you know, I'm a self-realizationist priest." You know, we can't always unify there. His explanation of life, his way of going at life, the way he helped people, was not my way. You know, I'm a college dropout. I have no degrees. And he was an academician and a Stanford PhD, you know, all very important things for the world that he lived in. And there's no unity there. It's just no unity at all. But the unity was the extraordinary preciousness of his life in the eyes of God and also in the eyes of those whose lives he touched. Now, this is where we're going. You know, we're going there in this temple through the inspiration of these masters. And they're leading us. They're leading us through the Bible. They're leading us through the Bhagavad Gita. Ever and again, through your awakened sons, the answer comes. And we have now added, you know, to the sanctity of our temple by putting up these images which remind all of us that every life is precious. And we're not about to change our practices or change our way of preaching. When Swamiji said the reason that that second pulpit was never used, Swamiji said, is because there was no minister in Los Angeles who could approach it from the position that Yogananda himself knew it had to be approached. The unity had to be from the way of awakening, not from the way of belief and the way of practices. And when self-realization comes to unite all religions, what is going to help us to understand, in just the same way that these ego forms that we carry are such a superficial overlay over the unity of spirit between us, so all of these things that we have called ourselves over time, I am Jewish, I am a Buddhist. I had one man come up to me, he said, I'm a Jewish Buddhist, and I go to the Methodist Gospel Church. I said, well, I think that works, you know? I think that works. Yeah, one of my friends, Shivani, she went to somewhere in the South, South Carolina, to a Baptist church to talk about yoga. She says, I'm an Orthodox Jew from Philadelphia. I'm here in Charlotte, North Carolina, speaking to a Baptist church about yoga. I think we've hit the new age, she said. You know? And that's what's really happening. And we're having a hard time holding to these forms. Because now we just have to see these forms as just like beautiful garments that we all differently wear. Because when Bill incarnated in this world, he had a very different destiny. Yes, he eventually came to Ananda and he brought his wonderful daughter to Ananda and he lived in our community. But he wore a slightly different garment. You know, he wore his academic robe, he wore his Dr. Yabroff attitude, he wore his guided imagery to help people in a psychological way. He was wearing one of these symbols in his own way. But what each of these symbols represent also, and this is another reason why we brought them in here, is we associate them in our minds with these outward realities, but they are not outward symbols. When I was in India on one cycle of our trips that we took there, we used to guide pilgrimage trips there, we would often be there during the festival season, it was called, when there would be Kali Puja, Durga Puja. These are images of the Divine Mother, big festivals. And you've heard me talk about this, that the neighborhoods would compete. They would get together and they would put up big altars to Durga and Kali. And, you know, a form starts out in a certain way and then it kind of gets revved up. The external things kind of get carried away with themselves. So the images of Kali especially, she's multi-armed, she has a garland of skulls, she has this long black hair, her red tongue hangs out, she's got her foot on the chest of her husband, Shiva, of her consort, like this. It's a pretty wild image. And she has a sword in one hand and then the other hand is offered out in offering a blessing. And I kept seeing these everywhere. And, you know, I'm an American. I didn't grow up on all this stuff. And at one point we were on a street, we were sort of in a crowd, and the crowd kept pushing us back. And all of a sudden, I turned like this, and there was a Kali. It was just like right in my face, and her sword was at my ear like this. I'd just been pushed right up against her. And it was just sort of like the last straw. And I said to her, who are you? You know, like, what are you doing here? And it was a very interesting revelation that came to me in that moment. I can only call it that. And it was sort of like she answered me, isn't life a lot like me? You know, just full of contradictions, isn't it? You know, just on one hand wild, on the other hand blessing. You know, life and death, this power coming through, and there's also in her this glorious freedom. And sometimes people think of her as Mother Nature, which is not really true, but still. And I thought, some great sage at some point had a revelation, and he saw her. And he wanted to tell us what that revelation was like. And by its very nature, you see, it can't be brought out into words. Well, you see, life is full of contradictions, and good things happen, and also difficult things happen. We don't grasp it with our intellect like that. You grasp it in its totality from your superconscious. So some great sage just made a picture of what he saw. And then over time, human beings sort of make that picture more like me. You know, if I can't be like Christ, then I'll make Christ's teachings a little more like me. One of my friends who was a minister was explaining to me how Christ's teachings evolved over centuries. The full teaching of Christ did not really come out until centuries later. I looked at him. I said, so the master himself, the avatar, didn't know what he was teaching? It took generations of priests to figure it out? I don't think so, you know? I think he understood it and they didn't, and so they gradually made it more and more like them. But you see, symbols are not so subject to that kind of distortion because they make a statement by themselves. What we think of as the Jewish star, you see it all over India. You see crosses everywhere. Even remember the swastika? You know, the swastika is the movement of the chakras. The Nazis reversed it. But it was a perceived reality. So these symbols are not really here just to say, oh, now we honor Judaism, now we honor Buddhism, now we honor the Tao. It's because they are in themselves windows to the infinite. Because they were brought by great masters to awaken us. The what we call the joy is within you symbol, which is the Ananda symbol there. Swami Kriyananda prayed to Master. He said, we need something simple that yet expresses everything of what we are. And he meditated and he saw it. It just appeared in front of him. He said he had to draw it about 80 times before he could get it just exactly the way he saw it. And then it can be defined, that going up to the mountaintop, the soaring arc of joy, the descent of spirit down again, the descent of the avatar, the little point looks a little like a bird, which denotes freedom. And there's all kinds of images in it. But he didn't get it intellectually first. He just saw it. There it was. You think of the cross. You think of the forces of life and the power that comes when you stand strong in that. The Jewish star is the three chakras and three chakras united like that. You see? It's the yin-yang symbol like this. And for Islam, we chose, instead of the crescent and the star, which many of our friends told us is more political, we chose the word Allah, just the name of God. Isn't that wonderful? Now, here we are, and now we have symbols representing what we're trying to do. But as Master said, Lahiri Mahashaya said when he gave a photograph to some of his devotees, if you deem it so, he said, this photograph will be a protection. Otherwise, it's just a picture. Because the way of belief must turn into the way of awakening. And when it turns into the way of awakening, then our lives become, we fulfill the destiny that God has given to us. What we'd like to do now is as I mentioned to you a moment ago, We realized when we put these up that these are holy symbols, and so we wanted to just have a very small ceremony just to install them into our sanctuary. So we're going to chant a little bit and then chant to each symbol. Yarambara will explain how we'll do that. And as we chant to each one, different individuals that we've asked who will take a candle from the altar and then carry it around and place it on that symbol. And then in that way we'll bring the power that each of these has to give us into our hearts and into the temple. I was going to start by reading Master's Book of Prayers, Whispers from Eternity. Is a book of universal prayers. And this is the dedication to the book, Whispers from Eternity. You might as well sit down because you're going to be there for a minute. Okay. In the introduction to Whispers from Eternity, he said, dedicated unto all the soul temples of Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, Hebrews, Hindus, and others, wherein the cosmic heart throbs equally always, and unto the multicolored lamps of all true teachings, in which shines the same one white flame of God, and unto all churches, mosques, viharas, tabernacles, and temples of the world, wherein our own one Father dwells impartially in the fullness of his glory.